Sie hören eine Veranstaltung der Leipziger Buchmesse. Für die Inhalte ist die Leipziger Buchmesse nicht verantwortlich. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
Die Messe neigt sich allmählich dem Ende zu. Aber nichtsdestotrotz, ich muss Sie mit ein bisschen Staatsbürgerkunde belästigen. Ordnung muss sein, das Bundesamt für magische Wesen ist hier. Sie wissen, Hexen, Drachen und Vampire sind im Grunde genommen kein Problem, man muss sie nur ordnungsgemäß verwalten. Und das war eine Tatsache, der sich auch der Staatssekretär im Justizministerium, Ulrich Kelber, nicht verweigern konnte, als wir beide bei einer Fantasy-Veranstaltung 2013 zusammenstanden und viele Hexen und Vampire und Elfen dort rumliefen, sagte ich zu ihm, guck sie dir an, da laufen sie. Und du als Regierung, du tust natürlich wieder gar nichts. Nicht? So kennen wir ja unsere Bundesregierung, tut nichts, macht nichts. Aber Ulrich Kelber hat gesagt, du hast recht, das geht nicht, wir brauchen ein Amt. Und so entstand das Bundesamt für magische Wesen. Und wir haben sicherlich hier den einen oder anderen versteckten Vampir unter uns, der hier lebt. Wir als Bundesamt sind davon überzeugt, der Vampir an sich will auch nur seinen Sarg im Grünen mit Geranien vor der Gruft. Alles andere ist katholische Gräuelpropaganda. Und wenn es früher so war, dass man den Priester rief, um den Vampir zu vertreiben, mal ehrlich, ist es heute nicht eher so, dass man den Vampir ruft, um den Priester zu vertreiben? Ne? Wenn man in die Medien guckt, ich meine Medien, müssen wir immer kritisch sein, ist klar, ne? Aber gucken Sie mal in die Medien, googeln mal mit dem Begriff Vampir und News. Irgendwas Kritisches? Eher nicht, ne? Gucken Sie mal mit Vatikan und News, ne? Da kommen so komische Sachen wie 2011, ganz toll, ne? Der Vatikan hat ja eine Abteilung für, ich meine, das sind ja auch die Fachleute für Ehe, für Familie und Kindererziehung. Nirgendwo finden sie bessere Fachleute als im Vatikan. Und 2011 hat Kardinal Ennio Antonelli, den Mann muss man kennen, das ist eine Konifere, also eine einsame Leuchte in seinem Gebiet, hat er verkündet, er hätte die Jugendbildungspläne der UNESCO analysiert. Ja, ist klar, ne, muss der Vatikan machen. Und Eminenz kam zu dem Schluss, dass die UNESCO ein Rezept entwickelt hätte, bis 2030 50% aller Jugendlichen schwul zu machen. Wow! Ne? Das können, also ich meine, man muss irgendwie Weihwasser zu heiß gebadet oder zu viel Weihrauch inhaliert haben, um zu so einem Schluss zu kommen. Man war bei der UNESCO auch einigermaßen überrascht, muss man sagen. Ne? Und so kümmern wir uns als in Bonn ansässiges Bundesamt für magische Wesen. Man kann uns übrigens wirklich besuchen. Wir sind jetzt hier mit einem Stand vertreten. Der eine oder andere hat ja unseren Dienstwagen gesehen. Ich kann Ihnen nur sagen, wir haben mehrere dieser Dienstwagen. Wir haben ein Amtsschild, wir haben eine Neonreklame, wir haben ein ganzes Haus. Und wer sich jetzt noch der Erkenntnis verweigert, dass es das Bundesamt für magische Wesen nicht gibt, ja, dem kann ich auch nicht mehr helfen, nicht? So, das Bundesamt für magische Wesen ist jetzt, um der Ehrlichkeit Genüge zu tun, natürlich keine Behörde. Wir gönnen uns den Spaß, so zu tun, als gäbe es Hexen, Drachen und Vampire. Wir sind auch keine verkappten Satanisten, wie uns das auch manchmal Leute unterstellen. Dann haben wir mal die Hardcore-Evangelikalen bei uns am Stand, die uns den Satan austreiben wollen. Fantasy-Fans kennen das. Wir sagen dann immer, Liebeleien, Satan. Das, was bei uns an Büchern über Hexen, Drachen und Vampire rumliegt, das ist nicht halb so blutig, das wie das, was im Alten Testament abgeht. Ja, aber das ist das Wort Gottes. Nö, Fantasy. Und das sage ich denen dann auch immer wirklich knallhart ins Gesicht. Liebelein, Harry Potter, Bibel und Koran haben eins gemeinsam. Es sind Bücher. Aber eins trennt sie. Wegen Harry Potter wurde noch niemand ermordet. Und in dem Rahmen sind wir Fantasy-Fans, so kenne ich eigentlich Fantasy-Fans, sehr offen, gucken sich alles an und haben ihren Spaß am Leben. Das kann man mit den Religiösen ja nicht immer umsetzen. Fantasy ist ein tolles Thema, wir bleiben dabei und lassen uns auch von den Religiösen da nicht beeindrucken. Zuletzt hatten wir, also als kleine Anekdote, bevor ich zu einem der Urväter der Fantasy komme, kleine Anekdote am Rande, hat mal wieder so eine Besucherin stehen, sie meinte, sie müssen mehr an Jesus denken. Ja, sagte ich, wirklich? Ja, Jesus, in Jesus leben und in Jesus sterben. Ihr sagt, ich möchte aber eigentlich lieber leben. Und ja, aber, ja gut, reden wir mal über Jesus, sagte ich dir. Ein Mann mit Anfang 30, unverheiratet, lebt bei Mutti, zieht mit 12 Jungs rum, macht laufend Party, hat eine beste Freundin, einen Jünger, den er sehr liebte, und stirbt dann zum Schluss am Kreuz in einer missglückten SM-Session. Also in Köln wissen wir, was das für Jungs sind. Und da war die Diskussion auch ganz schnell erledigt. Ne? So kann man Fantasy, so kann man Religion eben auch begreifen. Letztendlich sind es nur Geschichten. Wir tun das und verknüpfen im Bundesamt all diese netten Geschichten über Hexen, Drachen und Vampire mit dem sturen deutschen Hang, alles regeln und verwalten zu wollen. Und dann landen wir ganz schnell bei einem Mindesthaltbarkeitsdatum auf die Vampire, auf Blutkonserven für Vampire. Eine Haltungsverordnung zur Haltung feuerspeiender Klein- und Großdrachen in Anlehnung an die Bauordnung urbaner Habitate. Und da hat sogar die Polizei ihren Spaß mit. Die schicken uns gelegentlich dann Berichte zu, wenn irgendwo was läuft. Da gab es mal einen Einbruch in eine Blutbank. Jugendlicher brach ein, wühlte in den Schubladen rum. Da meinte der Beamte, Jungs, sagt mal euren Vampiren, dass Blutbanken keine Schnellimbisse sind. Derjenige möge lieber die Nachtschwester fragen. Keine Nachtschwester würde sich einem jungen, hübschen Vampir verweigern. Behördenhumor in seiner schönsten Form. Die Schweizer Polizei schickte uns ein Foto von einem Besen, fragte an, ob wir wüssten, ob Harry Potter unterwegs sei. Haben wir geantwortet, nein, das nicht. Aber es hat ein Freundschaftsspiel der Quidditch-Mannschaften mit den fliegenden Warmduschern der Bundeswehr gegeben. Die Bundeswehr hat sich dann gemeldet und dann haben wir für Bundeswehrsoldaten Flecktarn-Shirts mit der Aufschrift Taktisches Drachengeschwader Bundeslurch entwickelt. Und ungelogen, wir haben diese Shirts bis nach Inčukalns zur NATO geschickt. Und das ist eben sehr schön, dass auch Institutionen Humor haben. Was meint ihr, was los ist auf der Autobahn, wenn ich mit unserem Dienstwagen unterwegs bin und einer Polizeikolonne begegne und mich da einreihe? Polizei, Polizei, Bundesamt für magische Wesen, Polizei, Polizei. Die Blicke aus den vorbeifahrenden Fahrzeugen sind unbeschreiblich. Man sieht denen förmlich ins Gesicht geschrieben, von was für einem Einsatz kommen die? Um kurz auf das Thema Religion und Evangelikale zurückzukommen. Unser Gast hat da auch so seine Erfahrungen und Untersuchungen zu gemacht. Fantasy hat viele Väter, aber einen herausragenden Vater werden Sie heute kennenlernen. Michael Whitwer hat ein Buch über den Erfinder von Dungeons and Dragons geschrieben. Insofern betrachten wir ihn im Bundesamt für magische Wesen als einen Erforscher, als einen Botschafter in der Welt der fantastischen Reiche, in die er sich hineinversetzt hat. Und er hat auch Gary Gygax hat auch seine Erfahrungen mit sehr christlichen Leuten gemacht, die dann der Meinung sind, wenn man ein nettes Buch liest, welches nicht die Bibel ist, landet man schnell bei Satan. Wir sind eigentlich eher der Meinung, je mehr man liest, je mehr man nachdenkt, desto besser ist es. Wer immer nur ein Buch liest, der wird irgendwann rammdösig in der Birne. Und insofern freue ich mich sehr, dass wir Michael Whitwer aus Chicago haben einfliegen lassen können. Nicht auf Steuerzahlerskosten, wohlgemerkt. Ne? Ich bin zwar der Meinung, dass der Etat des Bundesamtes für magische Wesen durchaus seine Existenzberechtigung auch im Bundeshaushalt hätte, aber Finanzminister Schäuble ist ein oller Geizkragen, muss man leider so sagen. Deswegen freue ich mich, wer klatscht da? Schäuble ist ein Geizkragen. Also das wären doch mal vernünftige Subventionen für uns. So, aber ich möchte jetzt nicht länger aufhalten und das Wort an Michael Whitwer übergeben. Ich freue mich, ihn hier zu haben. Freuen Sie sich auf einen sehr umfangreichen und sehr guten Vortrag über die unendlichen Welten der Fantasie, wie sie Gary Gygax in seinem Buch oder in Dungeons and Dragons runtergebracht hat. Und herzlich willkommen, Michael.
Thank you, Klaus. Thank you. So I'm going to start with an apology. I only speak English, and I'm sorry about it. I'm in Germany, I'm speaking English, I apologize. I wish I spoke German, but I will tell you that I assure you that your English is better than my German, so I'm going to do my best here to speak English, and I hope you understand. I didn't understand anything Klaus was saying, but it sounded very funny, so thank you for that. Thank you for having me. Firstly, thank yous to the Leipzig Book Fair first for having me. Thank you very much. And then, of course, to my sponsor, Bundesamt für magische Wesen. Yeah, I've been working on that since I got here. And of course, we are at Stand 107, which is right down the hall across from Panini and right behind Nintendo Switch, so please do come by. And then finally, to Sunny at PR and Event Systems. I saw you there somewhere. There you are. Thank you so much, Sunny, for managing me and making this whole thing possible. So today I'm going to talk about Dungeons & Dragons, the most dangerous game. Sounds dangerous, doesn't it? So here we are. I'm Michael Whitwer. I wrote a book called Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax and the Birth of Dungeons & Dragons. I figured out pretty quickly in my research when I started on this book that the story behind Dungeons & Dragons is every bit as interesting as the game itself. And I thought it must have a very interesting backstory, and it does. So moving along, right along, I recognize that not everybody here necessarily knows a lot about Dungeons & Dragons. By a show of hands, can everyone raise their hands that plays Dungeons & Dragons? Okay, not bad, not bad. Okay, can you raise your hands if you play any role-playing game at all? Okay, that's good. That's really, really good. Okay. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about what this is all about, so forgive me on this one. So firstly, Dungeons & Dragons was the first role-playing game ever invented. It created the genre of role-playing games, created in 1974, and as everyone in this room that knows role-playing games could certainly attest, it's a very unusual amalgam of different things. It's got a tabletop rolling mechanic, it's got a narrative role assumption mechanic, so it's a very unusual set of things that came together at this time. Secondly, tabletop games, of course, are facilitated by a referee. In the case of Dungeons & Dragons, it's called the Dungeon Master. This makes it pretty unique, right? Think about board games of the time. In board games, you're playing against each other. You're certainly not having somebody that's dedicated to actually running the game, but that's, of course, how Dungeons & Dragons works. And, of course, in this case, the Dungeon Master describes to you what you see and what you hear and what you feel. And they also administer the mechanics of the game. So when you try to do something, there's, of course, a dice mechanic that determines whether you're successful or not. And then, of course, in Dungeons & Dragons, each player creates a character that has a unique persona and a tangible set of attributes that can be improved over time. Now, this is novel because before Dungeons & Dragons in 1974... there was no concept of playing a game cooperatively on an ongoing basis, let alone a situation where you could improve your character over time. That's very notable because if you think about any game that's made today, for a computer or otherwise, almost every game uses this mechanic. So in that respect, Dungeons & Dragons is extremely foundational to all around gaming. And then, of course, the game features a combination of narrative and miniature mechanics. So that is, of course, the idea of assuming a role. You play your character. I am Osric the Magician, and you speak as your character. You declare actions for your character. And the Dungeon Master, of course, will tell you how your actions work inside the game world. So, again, a very interesting, very unique game. And then finally, gameplay, again, is cooperative and ongoing. This makes it very unique. There were no other games that did this at the time. So if you're wondering, why is Dungeons & Dragons important? Why is Michael Whitwer standing on this stage talking about this? Well, the reason is simple. Dungeons & Dragons is among the most influential games of all time, very simply put. Can you raise your hand if everyone here does any of these things? Okay, that's pretty much everybody. If you do any of these things, you owe something to Dungeons & Dragons. Whether it's World of Warcraft, the largest massively multiplayer online role-playing game. Without Dungeons & Dragons, there are no role-playing games. Final Fantasy, one of the largest computer role-playing games. Even Legend of Zelda, which is more of a computer adventure game. But if you consider a lot of the mechanics in Zelda, the dungeon crawl element, even the idea of being able to get more hit points, that is derivative of Dungeons & Dragons. Magic the Gathering was... Wizards of the Coast, the company that created that game, started as a role-playing game company. They ended up buying Dungeons & Dragons later, but that was a derivative of Dungeons & Dragons. Game of Thrones. George R.R. Martin is known to have been a very prolific role-playing gamer early in his career, and he got a lot of his concepts and his ideas from Dungeons & Dragons. And that's not to ignore things that are a little bit less obvious, like Doom. Now, Doom, of course, is a first-person shooter video game. Now, this, of course, is the largest genre of video games out there, multi-billion-dollar industry. Well, Doom was inspired. It was created by John Carmack and John Romero, and it was inspired by their campaign of Dungeons & Dragons. And not only that, but of course there's a dungeon crawl element, of course, of Doom, and there's a first-person character assumption element of Doom. Again, these are novel concepts. They seem obvious to us now, but these were really groundbreaking things at the time they were created. And outside of all of that, you know, even the creators of Doom themselves have said they consider their game to be basically a real-time version of Dungeons & Dragons, where the dice rolling is continuous, and that's kind of how they thought of it. So again, the influence of D&D has been very, very far-reaching, and that's what really brought me to writing about both the history of Dungeons & Dragons, but also the history of Gary Gygax, a biography on its creator, because I basically thought via the transitive property, whether you know Gary Gygax or not, the thing that he put into motion became a much, much bigger deal. And for that reason, I felt him very important in history, and that was why I took on the topic. So there he is. Gary Gygax on your left there, and Dave Arneson. These are the creators of Dungeons & Dragons. They were co-creators. Their literary influences, I think, are worth... We're at a book fair. We might as well talk something about literature. So everybody assumes if they've played Dungeons and Dragons, oh, it's kind of a takeoff of The Hobbit. They kind of, or Lord of the Rings at least. They kind of took this concept, and that is largely true. A lot of the original tropes they used were very much Tolkien-esque tropes. But what's interesting about it is that Gary actually really didn't like the Lord of the Rings series. Really, really disliked it. He used to say, there's no action in it. This is not interesting. It's boring. What he was really more interested in was pulp fiction of the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s in the United States. Pulp fiction is a much grittier swords and sorcery style fantasy, not high fantasy like Tolkien, where, you know, you couldn't imagine Aragorn going around storming a dungeon, killing a bunch of things, and getting treasure. That's not what happens in The Lord of the Rings. But it's very consistent with what happens in Conan the Sumerian, Conan the Barbarian, by Robert E. Howard. That was one of his big influences. So Dungeons & Dragons was really meant to be a much grittier game than what a lot of people realize. And they used a lot of the Tolkien ideas to make it popularized to a wider audience. So I wanted to orient my friends here from Germany about where exactly we're talking about in the United States, where this whole thing starts. So this all starts in a town called Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is about 70 miles north of Chicago. And it's, of course, right there on the map, right near Lake Michigan. So in what we call the Midwest. I myself am from Chicago, so I kind of grew up near where a lot of this happened. One thing I wanted to point out about Lake Geneva, because it is important to the foundations and the development of the game, is, so Lake Geneva is a small town. It's kind of it's something of a rural, almost fishing type of town. It only had 2,500 permanent residents when Gary grew up there. But it was also kind of a country retreat for wealthy Chicago executives. So it kind of served a dual purpose. During the summer, the population would swell to 50,000 people. So it was an unusual town. As a result, it had a lot of really prominent buildings, and even it had mansions all around the lake. So it was a very unusual place for many, many reasons. One thing that I think is worth pointing out in terms of Gary's development is, so he grew up in that house right there. That's a grand green Victorian house in one of the neighborhoods of Lake Geneva. And he had a couple formative poltergeist experiences when he was a child. And he was convinced that they were authentic. They were extremely formative, and he mentioned them frequently. So I thought they'd be worth talking about today, given that we're talking about items of interest in the development of Dungeons & Dragons. So two things happened. So in the first occasion, when Gary was about, 9 years old, he had a sleepover, and he heard some thumping in the attic, and it was very peculiar. They couldn't find out what happened, and that was kind of the extent of it. It was a very important event to him, but there wasn't much more to the story. He heard some bumps in the night, if you will. Well, about 2 years later, this one is a much more interesting story to me. So he was sitting in the large parlor of that house right there in Lake Geneva, a house built by his grandparents, and he was reading The Fall of the House of Usher by the great American horror writer Edgar Allan Poe. And during one of the scary parts of the book, his cat, Q-Ball, was sitting on his lap. And in this particular room, it's a very large room, and there's a maid's room off the side, and the door was ajar. It was open, maybe a couple feet. And so what happens is, while he's reading this story, his cat kind of rears up, and it stands on its, you know, it stands and its claws dig in, and its hair goes on its back. It does the cat pose, right? The Halloween cat pose. So Gary's... Carrie thinks, what's going on here? And the cat's looking straight at the maid's room off of the parlor. So he looks up, and he swears he sees the door to the maid's room open 2 more feet, inward. And then he hears disembodied footsteps approach his chair and stop. So this tells you a lot about Gary. So Gary, of course, is terrified, and he's sitting there motionless. But he gets the hell out of the room, as you would expect. But he doesn't leave the house, as you would expect a lot of people would do. I would leave. I would get the hell out of there. But he doesn't. Gary goes upstairs and he gets his lemonwood bow, his bow and arrow, and he gets his machete. And he comes back downstairs and he monitors that door the rest of the evening until his parents come home. That tells you something about the creator of this game. He doesn't run. He arms himself. Very interesting. So one more interesting feature of Lake Geneva before I get into the real hard history of the game is, and again, this is a very formative thing for Gary. So Gary growing up, he's kind of a small town bad boy, right? He's kind of a greaser. He wore the white shirt with the rolled up denim jeans, the slicked hair with the whole thing. So Gary used to love to adventure, as you can imagine. He's an adventuring type. He's the one that created Dungeons and Dragons, after all. Well, in Lake Geneva, I mentioned it was kind of a wealthy town at the time. Well, it was for some reason in the late 19th century the home to a disproportionately large number of insane asylums. For whatever reason, there was about a half dozen in this small little town. Probably because there was a lot of wealthy residents that could afford to put people at these sanitariums. I mean, they weren't all institutional lock and key. Some of them were more like bed and breakfasts, probably. But this was one. This was a very prominent one. It's at the highest place in town. So Lake Geneva is a moderately hilly, you might say. And on the top of the highest hill in town is this insane asylum. It was called the Oakwood Sanitarium. So by the time Gary was growing up, Oakwood had long been closed. And there was a lot of rumors floating around about this place that it had been the home to very inhumane treatments and a lot of interesting experimental stuff. So by the time Gary grew up, it looked like this. It was the abandoned insane asylum in town. And so growing up, he would often wander the halls of this insane asylum. And he would, down below, there's all these laundry tunnels and steam tunnels that you could wander around. And they would find holding cells. And they would find shackles on the wall. Well, he later would talk about how, you can imagine how he got the idea for castle ruins and dungeons based on a place like this that was in his hometown. Well, so Gary grew up, as most of us do anyway, and he gets married very young. He actually drops out of high school, which always is an interesting point to me, that he never got a driver's license, and he didn't finish high school, which, again, for a very literary game like Dungeons and Dragons, is fairly surprising. He gets married very young, at 19 years old, and takes a job as an insurance underwriter at Kemper Insurance in Chicago. So it's a very banal job. It's a very normal job. And he grinds at it, as you would expect. Now, the commute from Lake Geneva to Chicago via train is about an hour and a half each way. So already at this early time, Gary is commuting basically 3 hours a day. And he starts having kids, as people are wont to do. He has many kids, as a matter of fact. He has a kid about every 2 years. So over about a 10-year period, Gary has 5 kids. And he's got this job, and he's got this little house in Lake Geneva, and he has a lot of trouble affording this lifestyle. He's not particularly well-paid, even though he's got a very stable job. Well, during this whole period, Gary gets very interested, very, very involved in his hobbies, specifically wargaming. Now, this is important, because this is really the foundations where it all starts, is with Gary and wargaming. Now, wargaming is not like Dungeons and Dragons. It's similar in the respect that it's a game, and it's played at a table. But outside of that, wargaming has a lot more to do with, and in this case, particularly miniatures wargaming has to do with recreating battles at a table. And I do say recreating battles because at the time, the idea with wargaming was not based in fantasy. There was no such thing as fantasy gaming. It usually was people like these two gentlemen, Gary Gygax down below on the right, and Dave Arneson up there on the left, his co-creator. This is at one of the early wargaming conventions. And they would recreate, say, something of the American Civil War on a tabletop, and they had various rules they would use, but it was all combat-focused, and you were meant to finish the game in one sitting, right? It wasn't ongoing, it wasn't cooperative. You were battling other people with your infantry people on your table, and that's how it went. You might recreate the World War II. You might recreate any number of Napoleonics. That was a very popular type of wargaming. But again, no fantasy element to this. Well, Gary gets very, very interested in this and starts contributing to various fan clubs, you might say, on a national level, trying to figure out why isn't there more medieval wargaming? Why isn't anyone playing anything that has to do with the Crusades or the 12th century England or what have you? So Gary, in 1971, decides to write a war game for the medieval period called Chainmail. Now, Chainmail is a miniatures game. It's a rule set, and it's completely combat-based. And the whole idea was that he was supposed to give wargamers the opportunity to recreate medieval battles. And again, I do mean recreate battles, not create something new. Now, at this particular time, it's a very interesting part in Gary's life because Gary has become unemployed. Gary is no longer employed at this point. He just had his fifth kid. He was fired from his job at the Fireman's Fund of Chicago Insurance, probably for playing too many games. It was known that he was typing up fan letters and games at night after hours. So I don't think he was very focused on his job. So his back is against the wall at this period, and he decides to write this game. Well, the game does pretty well. In wargaming circles, it sells a fair number of games, even though it's a very small hobby at the time. But what's notable about Chainmail is that Chainmail, the last 14 pages, has something called the Fantasy Supplement. Now, no one ever had done this before. Gary basically said, well, gosh, if you're going to recreate battles of the Middle Ages, well, that's kind of similar to fantasy, right, like Tolkien. So if you decide, I'm going to give you some rules, some very loose rules about how you can play with dragons and Balrogs and hobbits. You can recreate the Battle of the Five Armies. You can recreate the battles of Tolkien. That's very important. And this really got the imagination, the attention of the wargaming community. And as a result, the game was very popular. One person that played the game was a fellow named Dave Arneson, this fellow that he had met at various wargaming conventions. And Arneson started using that in his homebrew campaign. In a little bit different way. He decided to use these mechanics of fantasy miniature battle rules, but he added a kind of a first-person element to the game, this idea of playing one character. Well, Arneson and Gary Gygax started talking, as you can imagine, and 3 years later, they put out this, the first set of Dungeons & Dragons in 1974. Now, nobody had ever seen anything like this. There was no published game even close to this because, A, fantasy was still a very esoteric diversion at the time, a very fringe diversion. And that's the same to say with sci-fi. It's easy to forget at this point, while fantasy and sci-fi are such big deals today, in the early 70s, they were not a big deal. They were considered very fringe diversions. So this was very risky for them for many, many reasons. But they put this game out, and as you could expect, the wargaming community loved it. They were fascinated by it. They had never played anything like this, this idea that you could play a character and it was in the fantasy realm, and then you could actually roll dice and determine how things happened within the game. It was really a novel concept. So the game does well. The game does great, as a matter of fact. And as things continue to go well at the company that they found, called TSR, Tactical Study Rules, they create newer and better games and books. And this is a series of books that they create in 1977 through 79, called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Basically the same thing. There's some interesting reasons why they developed the game that I won't get into today, but they keep creating better and better games. Now, here's what's important about the story of Dungeons & Dragons, is it was a hobby game, so it was a very small and esoteric piece of the hobby market, and it was doing well. As you can see here, in 1977, TSR did about $500,000, $1 million in 1978, and about $2.3 million in 1979. So they're roughly doubling their revenue every year. They're doing very well. But this game is nowhere near mainstream. Nowhere near mainstream. This is something that's sold at hobby shops and places you might buy toy trains and things like that. It is not something you're reading about on the front page of newspapers. It's not a mainstream phenomenon. Until August of 1979, this gentleman, James Dallas Egbert III, disappeared mysteriously. Now, he was a 16-year-old Michigan State computer science student, and he was doing a summer term at the Michigan State University, which is in East Lansing, Michigan, roughly a couple hundred miles from Lake Geneva in the Midwest United States. And he disappears. You know, he's a very young college student. He's a very bright, considered a little bit eccentric, kind of a genius computer science student. Well, as you can imagine, his parents are extremely worried about this. So his parents hire a very renowned but somewhat controversial private detective named William Deere from Texas. And he kind of looks like James Bond, as you can see there. William Deere is a very serious but a very good private detective. His techniques are known to be a little bit unusual, but he gets the job done. So Deere comes to James Dallas Egbert III's campus at Michigan State University in East Lansing, and he looks around the student's room. No one knows where the kid has gone. And he finds a number of things. He finds Dungeons & Dragons books. How interesting. He also finds out from classmates of Egbert that he plays sometimes Dungeons & Dragons in the steam tunnels beneath the university. Now, this is this huge labyrinth of steam tunnels that exist beneath the university that go on for many miles, as a matter of fact. Kind of like a dungeon, as you can imagine. That's why they like to play there, no doubt. And then he also finds this bulletin board, which Deer is convinced, the private detective is convinced, is some kind of secret map that leads to the location, the secret location of James Dallas Egbert III. Well, after Deer puts all of these pieces together, he comes up with a theory, and a very important theory, maybe the most important theory in all of D&D history. He comes up with the theory, after watching some students play the game, play Dungeons & Dragons, that the game is so immersive, it is so immersive, that when you play the game, you have a very good chance of becoming your character. You lose sight of reality altogether, and you become your character. And when you become your character, you have a very good chance of basically falling off the wagon, and maybe you start wandering around the steam tunnels looking for monsters. This is a very dangerous state to be in. This is what Deer thinks, and it's what Deer tells the press. Now, I don't know what the press is like in Germany, but the press in the United States loves a good story. And that's a good story. That's a great story. This very strange game is leading kids to lose their minds. Well, in about 2 weeks' time, this becomes New York Times news, which is, of course, the biggest paper in the United States. So 2 weeks later, this is major news in the New York Times. Tunnels are searched for missing student, and there's a picture of William Deere there searching the steam tunnels. So this becomes a very big deal, and it really gets the attention of the United States. So as you can imagine, the press sees this and picks it up and starts running with it. And you see that the headlines start to follow. Fantasy cult angle probed in search for computer whiz. Student may have lost his life to intellectual fantasy game. So the irony of the whole thing is they find James Dallas Egbert III about 2 weeks later in Louisiana. And he's perfectly safe. He's perfectly healthy. He has not become his character. What has happened is he ran away from school because he had problems. He had problems, and he ran away from school. That was what happened to James Dallas Egbert III. But now that the press, and now that the country was watching this intellectual fantasy game, this strange game, everybody was really paying attention to it. Now, anytime somebody had any kind of problem, they would blame the game if they happened to play Dungeons & Dragons. So the James Dallas Egbert III theory continues on. By 1981, even though this case has long since been resolved, this author named Rona Jaffe wrote a novel, a thinly veiled retelling of the James Dallas Egbert III story, which is called Mazes and Monsters. Mazes and Monsters was so successful, they made a 1982 film about the game, starring, does anybody know who this is on the left? Someone said it. Tom Hanks. That's Tom Hanks in one of his first starring roles as the James Dallas Egbert III character in Mazes and Monsters. A terrible film, by the way. Terrible. So once the faucet has turned on about media attention, things get very interesting for Dungeons & Dragons. Headlines start spreading across the country. Dungeons & Dragons causes moral conflict, protest. Evangelists see game as front for demon worship. Dungeons & Dragons, just harmless fun or sorcery? Utah parents exercise devilish game, and so on and so on. And you can kind of see how this happened. Once the scrutiny around this game had started with the Egbert incident, basically nervous parents started walking in their kids' rooms, and they started looking at these strange books, and the books had spells, and they had demons and monsters. And so people thought, oh my gosh, it's true, it's all true. And this is how this demon worship business started. They saw it as a front for demon worship. So more groups started popping up, one of which was called BAD, Bothered About Dungeons & Dragons, B-A-D-D, founded by a mother who had lost her child to suicide, a very sad story. And she was convinced the game was responsible, and she founded a group, a coalition, to fight against Dungeons & Dragons publicly. And she had many powerful allies. She had pastors, evangelical pastors. She had censorship advocates like Dr. Thomas Radecki, who was the head of the National Coalition on TV Violence. Tipper Gore, the wife of our former vice president, Al Gore. And then people like Jack Chick, who was an evangelist and a cartoonist. Jack Chick felt he would connect with the D&D audience by creating what they call comic tracks. Now, these are evangelical comic tracks. So what you do is they're little printed pieces, like little flyers, that they would hand out on the streets. And what Jack Chick was trying to do was to illustrate the dangers of Dungeons & Dragons to people kind of on the level of people that were playing the game, you know, comic style. So what he says here is this. Which spell did you cast, Debbie? Well, I used the mind bondage spell on my father. He was trying to stop me from playing D&D. That sounds like my experience with D&D, very similar. And then Right down here, we've got the intense occult training through D&D prepared Devi to accept the invitation to enter a witch's coven. And then they say here, I've brought Elfstar to become a priestess and witch. Welcome, Elfstar. You're now a priestess of the craft and of the Temple of Diana. So, as you can see here, these were made in seriousness. These are not comedic. These were handed out saying, this is what's happening. Don't let your kids play D&D. Well, of course, the game also had allies. As you can imagine, a lot of people realized this stuff was all nonsense. People like Dr. Joyce Brothers, who was a very famous American psychologist, and people like Michael Stackpole, who's a wonderful novelist. He's written Star Wars stories, fantasy, you name it, who's written a number of pieces in defense of the game. But still, nobody could really fight off this onslaught of negative media attention. And this really came to a fever pitch in 1985, where Ed Bradley there of the TV news show 60 Minutes, which was a top-rated, still is a top-rated American news show, basically did a 20-minute piece on the game and really vilified the game, really kind of took the side of the negative press that this game was getting, that there must be something wrong with it. Well, here's the moral of the story. So, right, I can just move on. I think you all get it by now. So all press is good press, right? That's one thing we've learned about this. So this, the very same thing that was meant to suppress the game and to kill the game was the very same thing that was putting it on the front pages of every paper across the country. That's free advertising for Dungeons & Dragons. And so as you can see here, in roughly a year's time following the Egbert incident, the revenue nearly quadruples. It was doubling before, now it's quadrupling. And then, as you can see, two or three short years later, $14 million, $22 million, in 1983, it was about $30 million. This company took off and became a very mainstream thing because people were trying to keep it out of the mainstream, ironically. So that really is probably the most interesting part that really brought D&D to the doorsteps of so many people. It might be the very reason why we all know the game today. One of the mainstream pieces that was very interesting about D&D. Now, I mentioned that, you know, CBS had put out Mazes and Monsters, that terrible TV movie, and then there was 60 Minutes. Well, right in between those things, they had produced a cartoon series. Does anybody know the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon? A few of you? And I know it's actually very big in some countries. I'm just not sure how big it got in Germany. The D&D cartoon was a great show. It ran for 3 seasons. It was a top show for about 2 seasons. And ironically, of course, it was a kid's show, but it featured all kinds of interesting demon stuff. It had Tiamat, it had Venger, who was this big demon guy. So it was kind of really an unusual show to have as a kid's show, especially from the same network that was putting out 60 Minutes. But it was a very popular show, and it really drove the game to even higher and higher success. Toy sales, it got 100 licenses out of this game, many, many toy sales, many different types of licensed products. And TSR, of course, starts flying off the charts and opens an office in Beverly Hills. And there's a picture of Gary Gygax in his Beverly Hills office. For those of you who don't know Beverly Hills, that's where all the Hollywood actors and directors live, right next to Hollywood. So it's kind of the toniest area in all of the country. And again, TSR was in on that. There's some pictures from the Beverly Hills office / mansion. So by 1985, interest in Dungeons & Dragons, in spite of all of the controversy stuff, had started to wane. A lot of what happened with TSR is they'd overexpanded. They'd really expanded too quick, and they couldn't keep up with this growth. So what ends up happening is they overexpand. Gary has some corporate trouble. By the end of 1985, Gary Gygax, the fellow who created Dungeons & Dragons and the one that founded the company, is ousted from his own company in an interesting corporate takeover. I don't have time to tell all the details, but it's a very, very interesting story in the book. So he's gone from the company at that point. Well, the company is still suffering from a PR problem. People around the country still assume this game is dangerous. They still have a lot of problems. So a couple years later, by 1989, they decided, well, we need to fix this. So we're going to create a second edition of the game. Now, there's a lot of good reasons why they created a second edition. One good reason is if you play a second edition of Dungeons & Dragons, you need to buy a whole new set of books, which is very good for TSR, as you could imagine. But one other reason that was a little bit more of an internal reason, maybe an ancillary piece, you might say, is they wanted to make the game mom-friendly. They wanted a mom-friendly version of Dungeons & Dragons. So, interestingly, second edition does not have demons, does not have the assassin class and some of the more interesting, some of the more controversial pieces. And that was done very deliberately to try to make the game a little bit more accessible to a mainstream audience. Well, second edition was a fairly successful, had a fairly successful run, but But the company continued to overextend themselves as they were wont to do. And by 1997, they were on the ropes financially. They were almost out of gas. It was at that time that this little company called Wizards of the Coast got very interested. Now, Wizards of the Coast had created a little game called Magic the Gathering. Yes, yes, Magic the Gathering. So Magic, of course, became a huge, huge deal. And as you can imagine, a company that prints little cards and sells them for a lot of money is bound to make a lot of money, and that's what they do. So Magic does extremely well. So by 1997, this little upstart company is the king of the hobby industry, the king of the hobby gaming industry. And so they're in a position to actually buy TSR and Dungeons & Dragons along with it. Well, what happens from that point is that Wizards of the Coast decides, well, we need to put out a new edition of the game. We've kind of run our course with second edition. So this is when they create third edition. Third edition, and then a little bit later, 3.5. This is a very popular edition of the game. I understand this one was fairly big in Germany. Is that accurate? And yeah, I thought third edition was a tremendous game. There was an open gaming license. There was a lot of opportunities for the community to really engage not only in the playing of this game, but the design of this game. So it was a very successful edition. Out of 3.5, which was kind of a revision to third edition in the mid-2000s, what happened was a company called Paizo, who used to basically support D&D with various types of supplements. They would make various modules. Well, Paizo continued to make their 3.5 version, but Wizards of the Coast and the D&D intellectual property decided, well, gosh, there are so many people now playing Dungeons & Dragons, but it's not Dungeons & Dragons. It's something that's a derivative of our game. There are millions of people playing World of Warcraft. There are millions of people playing Final Fantasy. How do we get a part of that action? We created this industry. Why can't we be part of that? So what ends up happening is they create a version 4, a fourth edition in 2008. And the reason they do it, again, is to try to access this market a little better. So you'll notice even the art is a lot more referential to things like World of Warcraft. Oversized weapons, oversized pauldrons, something that's supposed to connect with the community of people, the millions of people that are playing Dungeons & Dragons, but not really Dungeons & Dragons. Well, fourth edition is not terribly successful. It's a very interesting design, but people really had gotten very, very fond of version 3 and version 3.5. And at that point, Paizo is the one that really took over that market with Pathfinder, which I know a lot of people play here. So we finally come current. Coming around 2013, Wizards decided that 4th edition was probably not the right step, so they decided to rethink everything and bring people back to the tabletop, to not become something that they're not, but to really remind people why you would come to the tabletop in the first place and play Dungeons & Dragons. So they designed this very, very successful, very well-designed edition called 5th edition here, which is, again, that brings us to now. This edition has been tremendously successful and has really managed to get people back to where they belong, really kind of in an old-school gaming format. So that pretty much is the story of Dungeons & Dragons. And I think I have just a little bit of time, a little bit of time for questions if anyone is interested. Yes.
Besides Dungeons & Dragons, what's your favorite role-playing game?
That's a great question. Besides Dungeons & Dragons, what is my favorite role-playing game? That's an easy answer for me. Star Wars, the role-playing game. That is a great question. Which one? I knew somebody was going to catch that. Yes, which one? There's been a lot of Star Wars role-playing games. Thank you. So the one I grew up with was one by West End Games, which is the original Star Wars role-playing game. And actually, something worth mentioning about the original Star Wars role-playing game, if you've never seen the books, at the time that came out in 1987, Star Wars was in a dead period. This is easy to forget, but after Return of the Jedi, the Star Wars intellectual property didn't do anything. I mean, they were silent. But West End Games decides to license this role-playing game. And in the role-playing game, now they have to describe all the planets and all the species, many things that were never given names before. Many weapons that were never given names before. They were just in the movies. So in a weird sort of way, Dungeons & Dragons is largely responsible for the expanded universe of Star Wars, because so many of the things that happened in those books ended up being used later in the latter films, and now in the Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. This stuff comes up all the time. It all goes back to the West End game books. So that's probably my favorite edition. I played it for probably 10 years, but I also played the Saga edition from Wizards of the Coast, and we just recently finished a campaign of the Fantasy Flight version, which is also... Every one of these is really good. All the Star Wars games are really good. Good questions. Anybody else? We've got one over here.
Which one of these many editions, of these five editions, did you have the opportunity really to play, and which one did you like the most? Because I myself, I played the third, fourth, and fifth, and I liked the third the most, so I thought I'd ask.
That's a great question. So the edition wars, we call it in the U.S. Which is the right edition? What's the best edition? So for Dungeons & Dragons, first to answer your question, I've played all editions. I've played all editions of the game, including original. In terms of what I like best, I will tell you that I probably like fifth best at this moment. Fifth edition, because I find it to be the most flexible of the versions. Now third edition is largely codified. There are many, many things you can do there are many very defined things you can do in third edition. So you have to be kind of really understand your character and buried in the mechanics of the game. Whereas original AD&D, original Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, didn't have a lot of that noise, you might say, a lot of those extra details. And fifth edition allows you to play the game largely that way. So I think fifth edition is the most successful recent edition, certainly, although I really do love original AD&D from 1977.
Over the many years of D&D, many modules was published, so which one is your most loved module to play?
Ah, the best module of all time. So adventure modules, for those of you who don't know what that was about with D&D. So a big part of their publishing was cooking up these pre-done adventures that you could run your team through. And these modules started about the mid-70s. Tomb of Horrors by Gary Gygax is, I believe, the greatest module of all time. It is sadistic. It is terrifying. It is everything you want in a module. And you have virtually no chance of survival. I know I didn't survive. So.
Weitere Fragen?
Another, yes?
Is there a rise in the popularity of D&D now with all the online Twitter or YouTube shows?
That's an excellent question. There is certainly a rise of popularity, and it's based on a few things. Namely, firstly, it's based on the success of 5th edition. I think people realize there is a very worthwhile D&D game worth playing right now, but I don't think that's the main drive of the success at the moment. I think the reason D&D is really getting a resurgence, right now is things like Stranger Things. The show Stranger Things, where, of course, all these kids are playing the game D&D, and they encounter the Demogorgon. You know, this is a D&D reference that I think a lot of people say, what is that about? What are they doing there? So that's one reason. There's an author named Ernest Cline who's written some really wonderful kind of retro future dystopian books, one of which is called Ready Player One, which is a big bestseller that's going to become a film next year, Steven Spielberg. That has a lot of D&D references to it, and as a matter of fact, Tomb of Horror references, to be exact. So there's a lot of pop culture stuff that's coming up now that is really pointing to the game, and I think making it very interesting to a lot of people. And I don't believe that is coincidence. There's been a lot of authors, a lot of people like Juno Diaz, who wrote the Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, who basically called D&D his apprenticeship in storytelling. Jon Favreau, the director of Iron Man, said, you know, D&D is where I learned to do storytelling. There are so many people right now that are kind of the masters of the information age that happen to grow up playing D&D. And again, I don't think it's a coincidence. What I actually think, and when I talk about Empire of Imagination, what I kind of mean by that is D&D was this early playground for people's imaginations. They would cultivate people's early imaginations, and the earlier adopters of this game became the computer programmers and the movie directors of the future. And I think it's really interesting how it's showing up in so many different ways now.
You said that you most like the really brutal module that pretty much killed you. On a more personal level, what do you think is... Did you have a situation where one of the masters, you, dungeon masters you played under, really took it too far?
That's a good question. The answer is no. I've never really played with a bad dungeon master, but there's a good reason. Is I've played not exclusively, but almost exclusively with my brother, Sam Whitwer. He's not only a wonderful actor, but he's a wonderful dungeon master. And one thing I do like about his dungeon mastering is that he's trying to create an experience. He's not trying to kill the players. I mean, I'll give you a hint. If the dungeon master is against the players, the dungeon master is going to win. He's God in the game. So he or she, I should say, is God in the game. So dungeon masters that really are advocating for the players and want the game to be about the story, this group storytelling element, those are, to me, the best types of dungeon masters because they're creating a very immersive experience for a group of people. And I'll go a step further and say that friendships created within the context of a role-playing game I think are very deep. And I believe one reason for that, because my oldest gaming group is my oldest group of friends. And I think the reason is because, you know, how many times can you say in any traditional friendship that you've stormed dungeons together and you've killed demogorgons and you don't get to do that in real life, and you don't get to have these kind of shared experiences. So that's one reason I think D&D is such a deep bonding mechanism. Good question.
So would you rather be a player, or would you like to be a dungeon master yourself?
Good question. I don't think my brother will ever let me be a dungeon master, but I'm going to talk to him about it. So the answer to your question is I love being a player, but I've only game mastered a handful of times, truly. So while I understand the mechanics very well, while I would like to do a little bit more of that, my brother is really kind of the master of dungeon masters, at least as far as I'm concerned. Anybody else? We've got just a couple more minutes. One over here? Yeah, oh, you again. All right.
I believe we all have been dice shaming at one point. How many times have you exchanged your dice?
You know, that's a good. So I do not believe in dice shaming. I'm going to go on record. I do not believe in dice shaming. I have a dice dungeon, which is a really cool little toy I bought at a convention. It's a little dungeon you put your bad dice in. But I do not believe in the bad karma of dice. I've had bad experiences, don't get me wrong. But no, I'm equal opportunity when it comes to dice. Good question. Yes.
You come here.
You're getting a workout.
The thing I right now come in my mind was, what would Gary Gygax say about seeing people cosplay characters from Dungeons and Dragons?
You know, Gary did have a chance to see the cosplay movement a little bit before he died. He died in 2008, so suffice it to say, cosplay has gotten huge since then. It was really not as nearly as big a movement before that. But he really had a chance to see a lot of the con movement happen. Gen Con had gotten very big before he passed away. I don't know what he would think of cosplay specifically, but I can comment on what he thought of LARPs. Live-action role-playing, he thought was really, really interesting. Now, to my knowledge, he never really officially did it. He always talked about as a kid, he would, you know, they would sometimes take his fencing foils and they would do things like that, but it wasn't really live-action role-playing. But he was really in support of it. He loved that it seemed to him that LARPing did the same thing that tabletop role-playing had done for all of his friends, which is it created these very tremendously strong bonds among people. And I've seen that. Now, you know, I'm not a LARPer myself, but I can tell you I've seen some of these LARPs where people will camp out together. This is a very immersive experience and a very great bonding experience. So I can comment on that because I've heard Gary talk about it. What he would say of cosplay, I'm sure he would be very in support of it. I mean, he was a member of the Society for Creative Anachronism in the 60s. So presumably he was very interested in this movement, but I never heard him comment on it.
Come here.
Hi, what was your first contact with D&D, and what did your parents say about it?
Good question. First contact with D&D, I was 5 or 6 years old. So this is the early 80s, mid-80s. And my brother, who was three years older than me, he had bought this big stack of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons books from the late 70s. And there was some great stuff in there. It was the Orange Spine AD&D books, the Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh, which was the first adventure I played. And so, you know, me and my best friend, Nick Aleph, we're like 5 or 6 years old, so we're not ready to play regular Dungeons and Dragons role-playing games. So, like, you're a little kid, so you're, like, sadistic, right? You're bloodthirsty because you're a kid now imbued with the power of playing a huge, 18-strength fighter. So what would happen back then is that my brother would get really pissed off because we'd be screwing around constantly. We'd be attacking civilians and things like that. So he would inevitably send like a 9th level monster against us to just take us out because he got so, yeah. So that was my earliest experience with the game. And you had a second question. I've already forgotten it. Oh, what did the parents think? Well, I'm going to tell you that my dad was fine with the game. As a matter of fact, my dad is the one that helped us buy the books from the neighborhood kid that was selling them. My mother was not as thrilled with the game. She didn't like it. She didn't like the game. You know, she had heard all of the rumors, and this is right in the middle of that period that we call in the U.S. the Satanic Panic around the game. So she was very much in that camp, so she did not care for it. So we had to play on the sly, on the down low.
Did you play with your parents?
Did I ever play with my parents? No, we never engaged. We always wanted them to like try it, right? There's a lot of reasons why you want your parents to try it, but yeah, we always wanted them to try it, but no, we never got them to play. It was always just me and my brother and our immediate group of friends, and we still play to this day. Anyone else? We probably have time for one more. I'm guessing about one more.
Wer von euch Lust hat, Michael ist auch gleich noch bei uns am Stand, C107 gegenüber Panini, also anzutreffen, falls ihr noch Gespräche mit ihm führen wollt, Fragen habt. Bei der Gelegenheit möchte ich auch gerne noch auf etwas hinweisen. Unser Bundesamt, die wichtigste aller Bonner Behörden natürlich, uns ist egal, wer Bundeskanzler ist, Magie hat es immer gegeben, gibt es immer und wird es immer geben, insofern ist völlig egal, wer Bundeskanzler ist. Wir haben einen Fantasy-Schreibwettbewerb ausgeschrieben für Schüler und Schülerinnen und wir kommen auch an Schulen, wenn man uns anfragt, um mit Schülern und Schülerinnen über dieses Thema zu sprechen. Wie schreibt man ein Buch? Wie entwickelt man eine schöne Geschichte? Auch dafür stehen wir bei uns am Stand zur Verfügung und natürlich auch für Autogramme, wer eins von Michael Ridwer haben möchte. Wie gesagt, C107, dort drüben neben Panini. Ich habe jemanden übersehen, sorry. Wir sind beim Bundesamt für magische Wesen gerade dabei, daraus einen kleinen Verlag zu machen. Wir sind selber überrascht, ehrlich, was aus dieser Schnapsidee geworden ist, die ich mit dem Justizstaatssekretär entwickelt habe. Das war wirklich nur eine abendliche Idee, aber da kommen ja manchmal die Besten. Und wir haben mittlerweile so viele Fans, was diese fiktive aller Behörden betrifft, sogar in Behördenkreisen vom Auswärtigen Amt abwärts. Wir haben uns beim Auswärtigen Amt einen Präsidenten ausgeliehen. Und bei uns ist das der kaiserlich-deutsche Vizekonsul Edmund Friedemann Drecker, Sohn der Komtesse Frohlinde zu Stolze ohne Zaster und des Pastors Gotthilf Drecker von Gumbinnen bei Sulaikinen aus Preisen. Und dieser gute Mann ist mittlerweile 128 Jahre alt, aber einen preußischen Beamten in seinem Drange, dem Vaterlande zu dienen, hält natürlich nichts und niemand auf. Das ist eine Erfindung des Auswärtigen Amtes aus dem Jahre 1937. Da hatte ein junger Diplomat keine Lust, zu einer Konferenz zu gehen und entschuldigte sich mit einem Anruf, den er erwarten würde von Herrn Drecker aus Berlin. Telefonieren war damals noch ein bisschen schwieriger als heute. Er war damit entschuldigt. Er hat es ein bisschen zu oft gemacht und sein Botschafter kam auf die Idee, was macht dieser Ministerialdirigent mit meinem jungen Vizekonsul? Rief in Berlin seinerseits an und bekam, den Drecker gibt's gar nicht. Und dann musste der junge Konsul dem Drecker eine Biografie verpassen. Und dann haben sich die Diplomaten in aller Welt den Spaß gegönnt, diesem Drecker Sachen in die Schuhe zu schieben, die der gar nicht verbrochen hatte. Um es kurz zu machen, und damit haben wir wieder einen kleinen Schlenker in die Vereinigten Staaten, als 1945 dann eine kleine Unterbrechung in der deutschen Geschichte war, haben die US-Behörden die Akte Drecker gefunden, einen solchen dicken Wälzer, fanden aber keinen NSDAP-Ausweis und haben ihn entnazifiziert. Er durfte also direkt weitermachen und hat dann zum Beispiel mal auf einer Eisscholle in der Arktis angeblich die deutsche Flagge gehisst und sie zur Kolonie erklärt. Darauf ist dann die DDR reingefallen, bis man ihnen dann beigebracht hat, den gibt's gar nicht. Und darüber gibt es auch ein ganzes Buch. Und wir waren mit diesem Buch auf der Roleplay-Convention, haben das einem Jungen in die Hand gedrückt, der als Ork verkleidet war. Foto gemacht, ans Auswärtige Amt geschickt. Junger Ork möchte Praktikum im Auswärtigen Amt machen. Er ist der Schädelspalten leid und möchte später eine Wellness-Oase in Mordor eröffnen. Im Auswärtigen Amt war man davon sehr angetan und als wir dann selber einen Kinospot, den haben wir übrigens dabei, über das Bundesamt für magische Wesen drehten, kam extra jemand aus dem Auswärtigen Amt und spielte den Drecker und brachte den Begriff der gendergerechten Außenpolitik mit. Alle bundesdeutschen Verträge mit Mittelerde müssen auch die Rechte weiblicher Orks beinhalten, denn im Herrn der Ringe in der Verfilmung tauchen keine weiblichen Orks auf. Wir wissen jetzt nicht, ob das vielleicht besser so ist, aber zweifelsfall, ne? So, und da gibt es so viele schöne Ideen und so viele schöne Sachen sind uns schon vorgelegt worden, dass wir uns im Bundesamt, wir sind ein Zusammenschluss von Autoren, überlegt haben, schöne Sachen selber zu sammeln und dann auch mal als Buch herauszugeben. Bei uns kann jeder mitmachen, der Spaß hat, diese bürokratische Sprache, also unseren Hang, alles regeln zu wollen, mit Fantasy-Mythen in Verbindung zu bringen. Und dann landet man natürlich... Zum Beispiel hatten wir mal eine Besucherin am Stand, die fragte mich, was machen Sie denn so als Behörde? Ich stand.
Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir sehen uns auf der nächsten Leipziger Buchmesse.